From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 29th day of June 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana, about the agricultural futures markets. Don Day will be here to take up the agricultural weather forecast. And we'll hear detailed accounts of crop conditions in Illinois, Iowa, and Nebraska. Those are the top three corn-producing states in the nation. In the second half hour of our program, we call that the Farming World, and you can hear it on most of these radio stations, and always online at willag.org. Philip Nelson, the president of the Illinois Farm Bureau, and by chance, a Seneca, Illinois farmer will join us to take a look at the 2012 Farm Bill and how things are laying out in his world at this point. And it all happens right here on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Leonard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Leonard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Leonard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
On this Tuesday afternoon, futures in Chicago finished the day like this. The nearby July at 442 in the wheat pit for the soft red, down 7.5 cents. July in Kansas City for the hard red, down 10.75 at 468.25. Chicago corn, nearby July, 325, 8.75 lower. September at 333.25, down 9 cents. December corn, $3.44, 8.75 lower. And the March at 357.5, down 8.5. And the soybeans, July contract, $9.47.25, down 7.75. August at 931.5, 9 cents lower. September at $9.19 on the day, down 7.5. And November beans, $9.12, 6.5 lower. January of 2011 at 922, down 6.5 cents. July bean meal futures, 289.80. They finished 250 lower. August at 281.20, down 210. July oil at 35.93, a buck and a penny lower, as it was the August at 36.10. June live cattle futures at $90.67.5, down 52.5. August live cattle at 88.75, down 92.5. August feeders on the day at 112.87.5, down a buck 10. September at 113.10. Down 97.5, and July lean hog futures at $78.75, 77.5 cents lower for 100 pounds. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, August contract, $75.80, or rather 87 cents a barrel, down $2.38. Ethanol at $1.46.9, 3.1 cents lower. Natural gas at $4.55.8, down 17.5 cents. July heating oil at $2.09, 7.3 cents lower. And the gold futures up $3.80 there at $1,242.40. The Dow at 99.16, that's 9,916, just about 230 points lower on the day. And the U.S. dollar at 86.03 is up 0.38 on the afternoon. The CRMB index at 256.27. down 7.26 for the day. The weather forecast says dry weather will dominate the heart of the Midwest. That through July the 4th. Temperatures will be cool today into Friday. Highs in the 70s, lows in the 80s. A few cooler readings in the north, and then lows in the 50s, that is. Low temperatures at night, of course, in the upper 40s and the 50s. Warmer weather expected Friday afternoon through the weekend, with highs returning to the 80s and the low 90s. Tropical storm Alex remains, may not make it to the Midwest after all, at least not directly from Texas. Some of the moisture may come into the Midwest after being absorbed by a mid-latitude cool front late this work week and into the weekend. Showers and thunderstorms will return to the Midwest during the early part of next week, says Drew Lerner. We'll learn more about the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of this half hour. We'll talk with Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Tuesday afternoon. On the phone line with us, Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Wayne.
Why afternoon, Todd?
Oh, I almost hate to ask it, but how'd you like the action in Chicago today?
Well, there wasn't a lot of joy in old Wrigleyville today. You know, it was just like Zambrano was throwing pitches at the corn market today. But I'll tell you, Todd, you know, as I told a few of my customers, I don't think I found any positive news on any of the news wires out there today. You know, we started out the overnight with China's stock market being lower, the consumer confidence rating going down, the crude oil down hard this morning, and the weather report talking about just great weather all the way through the pollination time as far as the corn went. So that with a lot of other things with the report tomorrow and people being a little extra long going into this and the sell-off that's happened and wanting to get even didn't turn into a very good day for the markets.
It seemed awful confusing, I suppose, for the producer at this point, who oftentimes, I think, is looking out at a crop across many parts of the Midwest, here in Iowa, in Indiana, in the northern part of Illinois, at a crop that they're just unsure of, that there's an awful lot of yellow if it's standing corn. There's an awful lot of ponding, and there's down corn and dead corn in it. And still, the numbers from the updates, as we'll hear in the crop progress reports a bit later in this cast, are pretty good and comparable with last year, I suppose. And even when with that all taken into effect, the statisticians seem uncertain about what really the crop progress should be like.
Well, you know, that's very true, Todd, and it does sort of make us sit back and wonder. We're at the same readings we were at the crop for last year at this time when we had a tremendous yield at the end of the year. We all can look out and see what we consider, you know, large areas of loss. And I know that most of the analysts keep throwing out the number, but even where we're at, if it's rated at this level, then that tells us that the good parts are probably better and will make up for the parts that are drowned out or parts that are losing yield. So, you know, the real question is, are the ratings quite correct and have we really figured in enough loss? And I think, you know, and of course tomorrow will be planted acres. It won't have drowned out acres in there for us to look at. So it is very confusing, and it is hard not to think that there should be a little bit of positive reaction for all the excess moisture we've had, the loss of nitrogen, the ponds we've lost, and the reduction in yield as we go out away from the ponds. So, you know, as we're trying to, you know, as we very selfishly look at our own fields and say that, why we keep a bullish attitude while the market and the funds continue to liquidate their long position.
And today was really ugly in the marketplace. Harvest month down at $3.44. Those are new lows at this point. How much more downside do you think might yet be in the marketplace? And I know a lot of it depends on what happens tomorrow morning.
If we get the numbers that the trade has, you know, their average estimate guess, and the continuation of the good weather through the middle of July to the end of July, depending on which meteorologist you're paying attention to, there could be another 20, 25 cents in this corn market down now. Now, if you want to be a real technician, and I'm not Dan Zwicker, or have quite his knowledge, but I have read in a lot of places where if you really want to look at it and this continues to collapse, we could go back to where we started the big uptrend back in 2006, which would be 250. Now, that doesn't mean I'm saying 250. That just means that it's a technical point that some of the technicians have looked and I read on three different news wires today. So, but I mean, you know, like I say, along the way, there are some people talking of sub $3 corn if the conditions continue to stay good. The other thing that's been sort of bad is the ethanol buildup that we've seen over the last few weeks and the way the ethanol has crashed. And that's had a lot of people worried about whether we'll come up to the USDA's projection of corn for ethanol.
You know, I'm looking at the December contract, and I'm wondering about this because we're down now. The low was, it came on the board. This contract, if I'm reading this right, and I think I got this right, this contract came on the board at 350 and a low at 346. So we're in that same range.
We're right where it came on the board then.
I hate to even tell people what it went to. Let's see, how high did it go, Wayne? Oh my gosh!
We don't want to talk about that. Silly and stupid.
You know what the high for this contract was?
No, go ahead and tell us, Todd.
$7.05.
And why didn't we all sell them?
Well, let's see. I could tell you that too, probably because that was back in June of 2008.
So we were all a little bit overly friendly at that point in time, and it just got burnt from selling things too early in other contracts.
I suppose that's right. Well, I think it's time to let you go on the afternoon. Thanks for being with us today,
Wayne. Okay. Tomorrow morning might bring some pleasant surprises.
Well, let's hope it does. Thanks
much. All right, thank you, Todd.
Wayne Nelson is with L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana, and joins us here on the Closing Market Report. That happens each and every Tuesday afternoon. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Here's the way USDA sees the crop progress across the nation by the week's end. 7% of the nation's corn crop as of Sunday was at or beyond the silking stage, 3 percentage points ahead of last year and 2 points ahead of the 5-year average, says NASS. That's the National Agricultural Statistics Service, by the way. Tomorrow we'll have Joe Prasaki with us during the Farming World after those USDA reports are released in the morning. Above average temperatures promoted rapid phenological development of the crop in North Carolina, where progress was 30 percentage points ahead of normal pace for corn. Overall, 73% of the corn crop reported in good to excellent condition. That is down 2 points from the ratings last week, still slightly better than the same time last year. Soybeans. Producers there had planted 97% of the 2010 soybean crop nationwide by June the 27th, slightly ahead of last year, but on par with the 5-year average, with the exception of Illinois, Missouri, and North Carolina, where progress had yet to reach 95%. Planting complete or nearly complete throughout much of the major soybean producing area. Nationally, 93% of the soybean crop has emerged, 3 percentage points ahead of last year, but on par with the 5-year average. Blooming underway by the 27th in all estimating states, with the exception of Wisconsin. At 9% complete, overall blooming progress was 5 points ahead of last year and slightly ahead of the 5-year average. Progress was most advanced in the Delta, where 30% or more of the soybean crop reported at the blooming stage or beyond. Overall, 67% of the soybean crop reported in good to excellent condition, down 2 points from the ratings last week and down slightly from the same time last year. Winter wheat nationally, 96% of this year's winter wheat crop at or beyond the heading stage, 2 points behind last year and the 5-year average. And boosted by the return of near-normal temperatures, 41% or more of the crop in Idaho and Montana began heading during the week. However, overall progress in both states remained well behind. By June the 27th, about 38% of the 2010 winter wheat crop had been harvested. That's 5 points ahead of last year, slightly behind the 5-year average. Now, here are the state statisticians.
This is Greg Tayson, Director of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Iowa Field Office, with the weekly crops and weather report for the week ending June 27, 2010. Iowa endured another exceptionally wet week across much of the state. Strong winds and storms early in the week gave way to summer-like conditions by the middle of the week, and Iowa finally received a couple days without rain. Dry, hot, and humid weather on Thursday and Friday gave cropland a brief opportunity to recover from excess moisture, but was quickly saturated again over the weekend. With just 2 dry days last week, farmers had only a small window of opportunity to continue with much-needed field work. Operators focused on spraying soybean fields, which are becoming highly concentrated with weeds, and harvesting hay when possible. The consistent showers have taken a toll on crops throughout the state. Thursday and Friday were much-needed dry days, but unfortunately, the break from the rain was short-lived. Heavy rains over the weekend contributed to more flooding and ponding. This surplus of water is causing crop condition and growth to vary dramatically. Some fields have areas completely drowned out by standing water and sections turning yellow with stunted growth. Meanwhile, crops on high ground which drains well are thriving. The earliest planted cornfields have just begun to tassel, and the crop is rated 72% good to excellent, down 3 points from last week. All soybeans in the northern two-thirds of Iowa have been planted, and 95% of the soybeans have emerged statewide. With blooming just underway, soybean condition rated 66% good to excellent, compared with 69% last week. This is Greg Tayson reporting from the USDA NAS Iowa Field Office.
This is Brad Schwab, Chief Crop Statistician with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending June 27th. Scattered storms were prevalent over much of the state last week, with some areas experiencing varying levels of storm damage. Wet field conditions are continuing to take their toll on standing crops and preventing producers from applying much-needed herbicides. Statewide, temperatures averaged 78 degrees, which was 4.1 degrees above normal, while precipitation averaged 1.79 inches, also 88 one-hundredths of an inch above normal. However, not all of the state was drenched by rain last week, as the two southern crop reporting districts reported virtually no rainfall, allowing wheat harvest to make excellent progress. Topsoil moisture supplies now stand at 2% short, 39% adequate, and 59% surplus. Growing degree day units since May 1 ended the week at 1,132, which was 124 units ahead of the historic average. This being the result of the continued above-normal temperatures Illinois has experienced over the course of the last 5 weeks. Statewide, corn in the silking stage advanced to 15%, compared to 2% last year and 6% for the 5-year average. The average height of corn now stands at 56 inches, well above last year's 27 inches and the 5-year average of 42 inches. Overall, the corn crop was rated in 67% good or excellent condition, down 2 points from last week. Soybean planting made virtually no progress again last week at 94% complete, and this compares to 87% planted last year and 96% for the 5-year average. 90% of soybeans have emerged, compared to 75% a year ago and 91% for the 5-year average. 6% of the crop was reported blooming, compared with 1% 1 year ago and 7% normally. Overall, the soybean crop was rated in 62% good or excellent condition, unchanged from last week. The soft red winter wheat crop was reported at 84% ripe, compared with 69% 1 year ago and 80% for the 5-year average. Wheat harvest advanced to 64% complete, compared to 40% last year and 57% for the 5-year average. This has been Brad Schwab with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service with the crop weather report for the week ending June 27, 2010. Warm temperatures and dry conditions the last half of the week allowed soils to dry and producers to get back into fields. The warmer conditions aided crop development. Producers are assessing the impact of the season's above normal rainfall on localized hail. Hay harvest has been difficult due to the extended wet weather. Feedlot conditions were starting to improve, but lots will take additional time to dry out. Corn conditions rated 81% good or excellent, below last year's 82. Soybeans emerged was near complete. Sorghum planting was at 99% complete, and sorghum emerged was 96%. Wheat conditions rated 71% good or excellent, below the 73% of last year. Wheat turning color was at 71%. A few wheat fields have been harvested in the southeast. Dry beans emerged was 92% complete, and ProSim millet planting was at 85%. Oat conditions rated 89% good or excellent, above last year's 74 and 69 average. The first fields have been cut. This is David Biar of USDA's National Agriculture Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
And I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. This is the Closing Market Report.
Support comes from Stewart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stewart-peterson.com.
Did you know grazing animals prefer grass of different heights? It's just one of those important little factoids a farmer must know to make the best use of a pasture. I'll have more in a moment. There are lots of animals that graze. We think mostly of cows, but grazing animals include sheep and goats and even horses. University of Illinois Extension Animal Systems team educator Dean Oswald says it's very important to know the grazing preferences and habits of the animals on your farm if pasture management is to play a role in their health and productivity.
For example, sheep prefer grass that is 2 to 6 inches tall. So if in a managed grazing program, we like to move them out of a pasture when we have 3 to 4 inches of growth remaining, we realize quickly that sheep, just because of their natural grazing behavior, will tend to overgraze, and that's where management comes in.
Sheep like grass to be 2 to 6 inches tall, but will overgraze if left on a pasture too long. Rotate them out. Cattle, on the other hand, like to graze a little higher up, something between 4 and 10 inches tall.
That doesn't mean that we don't have to worry about their grazing behavior, because we still want to maintain that 3 to 4 inch grass height when we move them out of a paddock, and they certainly will overgraze.
And then there's the king of the overgrazers, the horse.
Horses are another animal that just naturally will eat close to the ground because of the type of mouth parts that they have, and they certainly will overgraze and graze that grass right down to the ground. And depending on the species of grass that we have, that can kill out a good stand. So there are a lot of considerations that we need to make and utilize to manage the grazing behavior of our livestock just because of their natural ability and the choices that they make in grazing.
Choice is an interesting and useful perspective in the grazing world. This is where goats are unique. Their mouthparts, a narrower muzzle and split upper lip, make them browsers rather than grazers. Goats can be considered pasture renovators and will be useful to control certain weeds and unwanted vegetation. They can return a mature pasture to a vegetative, higher quality stage of productivity. Generally, says Oswald, in a good pasture system, 6 to 8 goats consume as much as maybe 1 cow or 5 to 6 sheep. Heavy brush browse systems will support 9 to 11 goats, 6 to 7 sheep or a cow. With mixed species grazing, 1 or 2 goats or sheep could be added per cow grazing to improve pasture utilization. This uses the different feeding habits to manage pasture and optimize animal production. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. In 2 minutes, we'll talk with Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming.
The Closing Market Report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from L&M Commodities, a full-service brokerage company serving area farmers with professional market advice and crop insurance products. L&M Commodities has offices in New Market, Indiana, Leland, Illinois, and Terrell, Arkansas.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the Obama administration says it has made new progress on a free trade agreement with South Korea. The plan is designed to end a 3-year impasse on a preliminary free trade agreement reached with Korea in 2007. Seoul hosts the next Group of 20 meeting in November, where a deal on the agreement could be unveiled. The Food and Drug Administration is urging meat producers to limit the amount of antibiotics they give animals in response to public health concerns about the drugs. The FDA says the use of antibiotics in meat poses a, quote, serious public health threat because they create antibiotic-resistant bacteria that can infect humans who eat the meat. Antibiotics have been used in meat to kill pathogens for more than 50 years. CME Group said yesterday it will raise storage rates on deliverable wheat futures. The change, which will increase the maximum daily storage rate for wheat by about 3 cents to about 8 cents per bushel per month, takes effect on July 18th. The variable storage rate system is intended to improve convergence between cash wheat prices and the futures contracts at expiration. And China and Taiwan today prepare to sign a trade deal that binds their economies closer and that Beijing hopes could lead to political accommodation 6 decades after the rivals split amid civil war. The pact will end tariffs on hundreds of products. And that's a look at today's business news.
Support comes from the Westchester Group in Champaign, an agricultural asset management firm specializing in the acquisition, management, and disposition of agricultural investments for institutional, corporate, and individual clients. Information at 800-607-6888 or at westchester-group.com.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It's a Tuesday afternoon. Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming is with us to take up the agricultural weather forecast. Hi, Don. How are you today?
Not bad.
Well, tell me about these weather forecast here in the Midwest. It is a gorgeous day. Looks like we're going to have several of them in a row.
Yeah, we really will. We are definitely showing signs and what we're seeing on our weather forecast charts, the way the jet stream's behaving, the way patterns are evolving, that it's just summer. We're just into a very typical summertime pattern right now. There's really nothing extraordinary going on. In terms of weather patterns across the United States, we're settling into a warmer weather pattern for all of the lower 48 states, especially here in the Corn Belt Midwest, and we're also looking at a pattern that is drier. The amount of thunderstorm activity, while there will still be thunderstorms in the forecast, the amount of thunderstorm activity is going to be less as we head into the next week to 10 days.
It looks like our daytime highs will be about 78 to 80 over the next several days, lows in the mid-50s. Good growing and sleeping conditions.
It really is. Now, there is going to be probably some opportunity down the road some where we are likely going to start to see those temperatures heat up a little bit. This is going to be especially true as we look ahead into next week as some warm air is building out of the southwest United States. But there's nothing coming that I would say would be blistering heat, anything that's going to get too hot. As you said, Todd, very ideal conditions.
In the southern part of Illinois the last couple of weeks, they've been drier. That's been good because they had soft red winter wheat to harvest. Will they continue to have good harvest conditions there? And what about the hard red winter wheat growing regions?
Well, it looks like for harvest both areas that there won't be any major problems with any harvest operations. Now, here's the catch. The only asterisk, so to speak, that we could throw on that is that some of the southern areas of the hard red winter wheat area may end up getting some increased thunderstorm activity from some of the remnants of a tropical storm, probably soon to become Hurricane Alex. Some of that moisture in the southern plain could creep up into there for some heavier thunderstorm activity, but right now, that's kind of a question mark on how far north that moisture is going to go.
And finally, can you check in on China very quickly, please?
China has had a weather pattern that, at least over the last week or two, has been warm and wet, and we see, at least for this week, that pattern continuing. Temperatures and conditions in China, not unlike what we're experiencing here in North America, not far from normal, warm but not hot, although the chances of rain over in China are going to be higher.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Don Day is with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, joins us here on the Closing Mark Report each and every Tuesday afternoon. Stay with us if you can for the farming world. If not, you can always hear it online at willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason. This is the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Our guest today by phone from his home in Seneca, Illinois, is the president of the Illinois Farm Bureau and a farmer there in Seneca. His name, Phil Nelson. Thank you, Mr. Nelson, for joining us today.
Pleasure to be with you.
Last week, you made a trip to Washington, D.C. on behalf of AFBF, the American Farm Bureau Federation, and discussed with the Agricultural Subcommittee on General Farm Commodities and Risk Management the 2012 Farm Bill. Can you take up some of the things that you told them about? And maybe there's a list that I have, and we can run down that. I think one of the first things, at least that I see you told them, was that you want it to be fiscally responsible.
Well, I think one of the challenges we're going to have, Todd, as we write this new Farm Bill, we're going to be writing it from a standpoint that we're not going to have the resources we had in 2008. And I think a lot of attention is going to be placed on what this bill is going to cost. You know, as you recall, in 2008, we took almost $10 billion additional dollars and put it to the food and nutrition programs. And coming out of the starting gates as we start these discussions on the 2012 Farm Bill, we're already hearing that, you know, there's going to be not near the money for the various titles, whether it's the energy title, the commodity title, and the Farm Bill. And having said that, we think that we are going to have to show the consumer today that this bill needs to be fiscally responsible. So having said that, I think as we begin these deliberations, we've got a farm policy task force in place as we speak, scheduled to meet extensively starting the end of July. We've got to really look outside of the box when we start talking programs within the Farm Bill, how we're going to fund them, and to what extent.
Yeah, on the fiscally responsible part, and you mentioned moving $10 billion to FNAP, or food and nutrition programs, in the last Farm Bill, one of the things that you told this committee, I see, is that you want the structure of the 2008 Farm Bill to sort of remain unaltered, and then there's a second line that says, don't shift money from one title of the bill to the other. Do you think that's really going to happen?
Well, one of the questions that were really being posed to the panel, and I addressed it, you know, can we take funds from one title and move them to another to get to a program? And I guess my concern is, if you've got a program working and you start pulling resources away from that, you may take an effective program and literally destroy it. And that's a concern of ours when you start the shifting and trying to take resources. Crop insurance is a good example. The current SRA that's being discussed out there, they're looking to take anywhere from $4 to $6 billion out of crop insurance. The question that I posed the congressmen and women that were on this subcommittee, if you start pulling $4 to $6 billion out, let me be assured that you need to basically consider, is that going to affect or impact the delivery of that product or potentially the cost to the producer that purchases those products? And that's extremely essential from an Illinois perspective, because we're a big user of risk management policies for crop insurance.
And, of course, there's country insurance there, too, so you have kind of a two-edged sword to have to deal with.
Well, where they're going in the SRA is basically looking at seeing if they can pare down some of the administrative costs in the delivery mechanism of crop insurance. But having said that, you know, just a year ago, they modified the GRIP insurance, which has been, in the past, a fairly popular risk management product in Illinois. As you recall, Todd, they really cut out the delivery of that in the southeast and the south, where you can't even purchase that anymore. So I think the word of caution that I have is hopefully there's not unintended consequences when you start looking at paring some of these programs back, because, as I said, whether you look at the ACRE program, the SURE program, the buy-up levels of crop insurance, farmers look to these particular products to try to at least minimize some of the risks that they have in planting and producing crops and livestock.
Colin Peterson has not made it any secret that direct payments seem to be up on the chopping block at this point. What are your concerns?
Well, you know, we have a philosophical difference, I think, that we've got to overcome, because during the last Farm Bill, if you recall, Illinois Farm Bureau took some proposals to the table at the American Farm Bureau level to look at everything. And we said, I think, from Illinois' perspective, if we could ramp up the acre program, i.e. take it from a state trigger to a county trigger, and do things such as that to beef up the risk management products, our people were telling us that's the direction they wanted to head. And as a result of that, if you recall in the last Farm Bill, to sign up for ACRE, you would give up 20% of your direct payments in lieu of going to the ACRE program. I think you're going to see more of that particular trade-off going into this Farm Bill, but I think one of the biggest obstacles you have to overcome is coming out of the South. The Southern producers don't want to really deviate or shift from those direct payments, much more so than an Illinois producer. But given the circumstances around ACRE right now, the participation has not been as great as they would have liked to have seen it. But I think, as I stressed to the subcommittee, I think they need to simplify the program, make it more understandable, and I think if we can address maybe some of the trigger mechanisms of it, we would have more participation in it.
Why is it, do you think, that the Southern producers would be less likely to be willing to give up a direct payment than those in Illinois?
Well, I think a lot of it's the comfort level. Whether you're a cotton or rice farmer, I think some of it is the, the risk that they have with crops. As I stated in my testimony, the SURE program, which took, I think, $4 to $5 billion out of the last Farm Bill to put it into the SURE program, which was supposed to basically address the southern growers' concerns as it related to disaster bills. And as I stated last week, the ink had not even hardly dried on that SURE program from the regulatory standpoint and the rule standpoint. And there was, you know, they've had two droughts in a row in parts of the southeast and the south. So they already started putting together an ad hoc disaster program over and above the SURE program. And I think, philosophically speaking, I believe as we craft the 2012 Farm Bill, and this is what I challenged the subcommittee on, philosophically speaking, I think they need to determine whether the SURE program is a disaster bill or disaster program, or is it simply an extension of crop insurance where producers don't take crop insurance and they rely on this SURE program as their safety net? So I think we need to address that as we go into the 2012 Farm Bill, because it's quite clear when you have back-to-back disaster programs, there's still the part of Congress that writes those disaster programs, and the intent when we wrote the last Farm Bill was not to do that, and that's what this was set aside for.
About ACRE, the Average Crop Revenue Election Program, you suggest it needs to be easier to sign up. I've heard from many producers that it seems confusing, or that it just, confusing might be, that's usually the word they use, but I think it's time-consuming more than anything else. What can happen to make it easier to do?
I think it's all of the above. It's confusing. It's time-consuming. It can be complicated. And as I pointed out last week, that what we're hearing from producers when they have to come in and bring their yields in, and they just to sign up, you have to look at 5 years, and you decide whether to use your yields or a plug yield from the FSA office. I think it needs to be streamlined, and if they could parallel more of the crop insurance and we could get away from some of the laborious paperwork that's involved, I think producers would warm up to it a little bit more than they have. And those are the things that I think that we have to ask ourselves. Is it a resource standpoint? Is it the way the program is structured? Can it be simplified through the computer much more so than what it is today? That's the pushback, and I think the challenge that I left last week that I think we need to look at if this is the direction we're headed. And, you know, as far as the Illinois Farm Bureau is concerned, we studied the Canadian program, which is, I guess, somewhat similar to ACRE, except it does go to the county trigger level, and they've had that in place now going on, I think, 4 or 5 years. So they've experienced some of the challenges of the startup of a new program to where it is today, but producers north of the border seem to be, I guess, somewhat pleased by that program after they've gotten through the initial first few years.
What do other states think about ACRE? Iowa doesn't seem to be thrilled by this process.
I think it's the fear of the unknown, Todd. You know, if you have a program and you go back to direct payments and you know what that direct payment will be and look like and structured, and you don't have near the paperwork that you have with the new program, I think that fear of giving up something to get something that you don't really understand and you don't know about, that's probably the biggest fear. And I credit, you know, whether it's your campus and that has done a lot of studying on it, our organization has done a lot of research on it, and we've tried to provide that to producers so that they better understand the program. That's probably why Illinois leads the country in the ACRE sign-up as opposed to an Iowa or Indiana. And I think basically producers are saying, I'm going to stay with something that I know rather than venture into something that I don't know. And until we address it and modify it and streamline it, I think that's going to be the case. With ACRE, to get more participation, we need to get it to a trigger level that more reflects the production on a particular farm.
World Trade Organization rulings, you say, should be considered. Of course, that probably means just one thing, and it's the GSM 102 program, or the export program for cotton.
And we are going to have to deal with that, because since the writing of the last farm bill, as you know, Todd, we had a ruling against us as it related to the particular cotton program. So as we write the new farm bill, I think we do have to keep in mind the WTO issues that are involved. And I think that might, you know, structure the farm bill a little bit differently. It will, especially in the cotton program. But as we start talking about some of these other nuances of the ACRE program, direct payments and that sort of thing, we still have to be somewhat compliant, or we're going to get another challenge as we go forward implementing a new farm bill.
We're talking today with Phil Nelson. He is the president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. This is The Farming World from the University of Illinois campus in Urbana-Champaign. More in a moment.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tom Testel and Morris at 815-941-2184. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
It's National Almond Butter Crunch Day. It's also Feast Day of St. Peter, patron saint of fishermen, bakers, and harvesters. On this day in agricultural history, in 1943, General Dwight D. Eisenhower requested that Coca-Cola provide 10 portable bottling plants for U.S. troops overseas. Eisenhower's telegram requested 3 million bottles of Coca-Cola, complete equipment for bottling, washing, and capping 3 million bottles twice a month, and sufficient syrup and caps for 6 million refills. In 1956, now President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed the Interstate Highway Act, which made possible the modern interstate highway system in the U.S. The act committed federal funds to the states for 90% of interstate highway construction. By the way, three states, Missouri, Kansas, and Pennsylvania, lay claim to the first to take advantage of the act. In 2004, Roy Wofford died, an American pathologist. He pioneered and wrote books on the idea of restricting food intake to extend lifespan. And in 2005, the USDA confirmed the second domestic case of mad cow disease in the U.S. The 12-year-old cow was born in Texas and spent its whole life on the same ranch. The first case, discovered in December of 2003, was in a dairy cow that had been imported from Canada. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Our guest on the phone line, Phil Nelson from Seneca, Illinois. He's a farmer and the president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Mr. Nelson, we're talking about agricultural policy. What are the other things that we should take up for the 2012 Farm Bill?
Well, as we start looking at it, we usually challenge our membership to, you know, you can reflect on what's in the 2008 Farm Bill, but we try to think outside of the box. You know, we've had some comments from livestock producers whether they should be included and to what extent as we write a new farm bill. We've talked a little bit about already what the emphasis should be on the energy title. If you recall in the 2008 farm bill, we had a lot of comments as far as how do we ramp up ethanol, biodiesel, how do we be a part of the solution. I think that needs to continue. We are disappointed that EPA has not acted on the RFS2. It doesn't look like that's going to happen until September. I think also one of the bigger challenges that we're facing right now is the tax credits as it relates to our renewable fuels. The biodiesel industry right now has almost come to a shutdown phase. 80% of that production has been idled because the tax incentives haven't been in place to try to jumpstart that new industry. We're going to go through the same situation with the ethanol tax credits. And I think as we look at those pieces of what we think are an integral part of the overall picture, I think we need to address those. And the Farm Bill is certainly going to be an avenue that we're going to look at that. Even bigger than that, I think one of the biggest challenges that I think we face from a state perspective and from a national perspective is the funding of research. I think as producers, we all know and realize that if we're going to stay on top of the production and the efficiency side of things, we have to develop a research mechanism from a funding standpoint to accomplish that. And that's certainly something that's near and dear to you coming from a land-grant institution. And given the challenges that we're facing on the state as well as the federal level from a fiscal standpoint, we're going to have to address that, and we're going to have to think outside of the box of how we fund those particular programs.
Let's come back to the biofuels for just a second. Why are they letting, do you think, the biodiesel industry die on the vine at this point? At first, they said, well, we just don't have time. We're taking up health care, but that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And if they come back with an E15 for ethanol, but say 2007 and newer vehicles, is that considered a loss?
Yeah, and I think that's the bigger issue is we think we've got the research behind this to move forward. And there's just seemed to be the reluctancy. And I guess I am a little taken back, given what we're dealing with in the Gulf, and hearing the hue and cry that we've got to look at a comprehensive energy policy so that we address all elements of energy. I am a little surprised Congress has not taken this up, and especially when we've heard the president during the rural summit swing through the Midwest about how important biodiesel was and ethanol, I am a little concerned that we haven't moved forward on this. So we continue to ramp that heat up because we think we've got the opportunity to do it, but it's just a number of things that aren't getting paid proper attention to, and I think we all suffer from it, whether it's the RFS2, whether you look at the estate tax that still has not been delivered at this point in time as to what we're going to do with it. And you look at the free trade agreements that are sitting on the shelf. There's three of them that basically have been negotiated, and now we've got other countries that are coming in and basically, capturing those markets that we think we should be filling. So I think we've got to pay attention to all facets of what we're looking at today, whether it's trade or research or tax credits. They all have an impact on the producer side of things.
One last thing. The Packers and Stockyards Act is up on comment period for new kind of rule implementation. What's the Farm Bureau think about those in Illinois?
Well, Todd, we've been working on this particular issue for a half a dozen years. Shortly after I came in as president, we've had a concern from a packing standpoint and from a producer standpoint to make sure that we had adequate transparency in the marketplace, that when a packer would buy another packing plant and in a couple cases turn around and shut those down, from a regional standpoint, it had an impact on the price that a farmer received for that particular product. And we brought that to DOJ's attention. I think we're at least pleased that they're going to go back and look at some of the enforcement of the Packers and Stockyards Act. We've said all along for the last couple of years specifically that there probably isn't a problem with the overall act because some of the nuances in that act really address what we're talking about here. But the problem has been we haven't enforced that. And now as you start looking at the packing industry where five packers basically harvest about 80% of all the livestock in this country, it's starting to become a challenge. So hopefully within the Department of Justice and with the United States Department of Agriculture working with them, we can address some of these very important issues to make sure that we've got adequate transparency in the marketplace to price our commodities.
That's Philip Nelson, president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. He's been having a discussion with us here on The Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.